Before the episode begins, I'd like to talk to you about Health.Tech, a unique conference happening at the International Congress Center in Munich on June 5 and 6, blending top-tier content and exclusive opportunities to meet leaders and founders from the health tech ecosystem. The event is co-founded by EIT Health, Roche, and Bitton Brettles, the team that created one of the largest founders festival of the same name, which Michelle Obama, Richard Branson, and Jessica Alba, just to name a few, attended. Their idea for Health.Tech was simple. Take the ingredients that made Bits and Pretzels so successful and apply them to the health sector. The result is a unique conference where more than 3,500 participants representing payers, providers, patients, startups, investors, and corporates connect, share insights, and join forces to catalyze growth opportunities in health tech. 2 days to think and act together on the future of health. I joined the event the last 2 years, and for 2024, I'm honored to be among the selection of thought leaders who act as ambassadors on behalf of Health.Tech. To secure your ticket, head over now to health.tech/tickets and get 20% off with the code MATHIEUC20, that is MATHIEUC in capital letters, underscore 20. I look forward to seeing you there. Now back to the episode.
If you have someone who's about to die, because he cannot find a suitable bone marrow donor, or you have a woman who, for natural reason, or just because he actually got chemotherapy and she overcame cancer, but her ovarian reserves are so low that she doesn't have eggs. So do these individuals have the right to give, with the knowledge and full consent as adults, stem cells and make embryo models from their cells to day 40 or day 70, depending on the organ that is needed, and take pills and save his life, or being able to make her own eggs so she can go to a regular fertility clinic and, with her husband to experiment. So that is, I think, the scenario.
Welcome to Impulse, the podcast where we dive into the most exciting breakthroughs in healthcare of our time. In each episode, I sit down with some of the most brilliant minds that are using technology to rethink the way we care. Inspiring and passionate to tell you all about their innovation and how it will impact the lives of millions. My name is Matthew Chafford. I'm a biomedical engineer and medical technology enthusiast. And in this podcast, we take the pulse of this incredible field. Welcome to Impulse. So welcome to Impulse, Jacob. I'm really honored to have you on the show for this new episode, which will be quite special, I'm sure. We got in touch through a common friend, so Leo Grunstein from Spider, I hope I'm pronouncing the name correctly, whom I also had the chance to interview last year, where he shared with us the impressive work that he and his team are doing to advance how we can measure blood glucose in our body continuously and non-invasively. So it was a really fascinating episode. I think it was number 23, if I remember correctly. And yeah, I can only recommend it to give it a listen. And in case you're listening to us, Leo, we send you our warm greetings. I have to admit, Jacob, that I feel a bit nervous on one hand because I'm not an expert on human developmental biology, and we probably go quite deep in the topic today, simply because it's at the core of the research that you lead at the Weizmann Institute. And also feel nervous because you are one of the most renowned scientists in the field, and I don't want to disappoint our listeners by asking two naive questions. My nervousness aside, I look forward to learning from you about the revolutionary work you've done and continue to do with human embryo models to understand how the underlying technology works, how we create them, and what perspectives and applications they bring, both from a clinical and a research standpoint. But before we head there, I'll ask you the same intro questions that I've asked all my guests in the podcast so far. Would you like to present yourself?
Sure. So first of all, thanks for having me here, and nothing to be nervous around. I mean, thank you for giving me the opportunity to explain this. I think in explaining our research to the public, the general public, is something very important because we want to engage the public. My name is Jacob Hanna. I'm a professor of stem cell biology and embryology at the Weizmann Institute of Science in Rehovot in Israel. I'm originally trained as an MD, actually, but I don't practice. I've joined the stem cell field for 17 years now since the discovery of iPS cells. I did my postdoc at MIT for 4 years. And in 2011, I started my own lab at the Weizmann Institute. And I've been there since that time. I have a group of about 15 people. Do we ask very fundamental questions about what are stem cells and these embryonic stem cells and what should we expect from them from different species? And since they represent embryo developmental states, and perhaps it's natural, this our research has now become into this, now people call it stembryology, which is really the meat, stem cell and embryology, to try to answer questions about both, actually. So we do from basic research and applied research. And recently, we've also started a company called NeuroBio that aims to try to develop this knowledge further for health applications in the future.
Super. And so you mentioned that you were an MD by training. You know, what made you go into the direction of, you know, developmental biology research? Like, what was the transition, or what was the wake-up call in a way?
Yeah, it's interesting. It was a kind of a process. I found myself, as you're going through the clinical stages of the training, being brought to not only treatments and diagnosis, but really try to understand the etiology and how the disease formed. And I found, like, a lot was unknown. I was amazed how much was unknown, and I started, you know, getting interested in that. And also, I was very influenced by my uncle, who I'm very close to. He was a lead scientific officer of a very prominent biotech company. He actually made the first antibody drug treatment ever.
Oh, wow.
Rituxan for lymphoma, and he's a very successful researcher. And he always encouraged me to develop that inquiry more. So actually, and then I did my PhD in immunology and in the hematopoietic system. But for my postdoc, I transitioned to the stem cell field. Just at the time, I felt there was so much unknown, and still there was so much unknown. Felt that I should try something new.
And why is it so? Like, why is it so? Why do we know so few about so human post implantation development? Basically, how do you explain it?
It's a very young field overall. I mean, in general, if you think of stem cells. The first mouse stem cells were derived perhaps 40 years ago, and human stem cells 25 years ago.
Yeah.
So that's actually not a lot of time. And then when you go into the human part, exactly, and the human embryology, it really gets complex because the human embryo, so we can grow embryos in the dish until the 64 cell stage, which is called the blastocyst.
Yeah.
And that is why in vitro fertilization IVF treatment exists, because we have that ability. However, once you pass that stage, you must insert the embryo back into the uterus. And the uterus is a black box. And as soon as the embryo in all mammalians enters the uterus, very, very quickly makes all of its organs. So basically in humans, the end of week 5 to 6, let's say, all organs have already formed, and the rest of pregnancy is just growth. And obviously the embryo is very small. It's inside the uterus. Women usually maybe don't know they're pregnant at that stage. It's very hard to get material or complete material for justified ethical and technical reasons. Really, it is a black box. It's not a cliche when we talk about that period. We know at later stages, of course, because of ultrasound and pregnancies and preterm babies, you know, about development. But that area is done. And I want to say even non-human primates, which are used as a model, also are very hard to study pregnancy at these stages as well, because, you know, very few embryos and ethical regulations. So that it is a main challenge that, you know, the field is now finally has to take on, basically.
Understood. And so your research made the headlines in September last year. So, for example, being recognized by Time Magazine as one of the most significant inventions of 2023, which I believe says quite a lot about it. following the publication of your paper, that was called Complete Human Day 14 Post-Implantation Embryo Models from Naive Embryonic Stem Cells. So it's a complicated sentence that was published in Nature. For our listeners who are neither experts in embryology or human developmental biology, can you explain what you and your research team achieved?
Yeah. So, you know, the paper you mentioned is, I guess it's kind of a, I don't know what I call it, the climax, because there's still not much left to do. But it's a combination of different lines of efforts and the research that I will explain them to understand what we're trying to do and what happens in this world like. The idea is we've been very much studying for a while so we can make stem cells, either derive them from donated embryo or actually you can take a skin cell or a blood from any adult, on any kid, and revert the cells back to become a stem cell. These are called induced
pluripotent.
This is an invention by Yamanaka in 2007, for which he got the Nobel Prize. But then it has been very challenging because the idea is great. You know, let's say I'm a patient, I need a new bone marrow cells, and I don't need to look for a donor, which is often very complicated, and the match is never perfect. So I can, you know, you can take stem cells, make them from my skin. I don't have to look for donors. I would never reject them. But so we know how to make these stem cells, but actually it's proven very difficult to differentiate them into different cell types. So for transplantation, you have to transplant a defined cell type. So if you just inject stem cells into like the lungs, they're not going to learn from their neighbor.
Yeah, they're not going to differentiate from their own.
And so therefore, we need to develop protocols how to move forward. And if you think about what is moving forward, you need to imitate the embryo. But in case of the humans, we don't know what we want to imitate. We don't have such access. And then there's a lot of achievements still. We can do a lot of stuff with maps in human cells, but we were also interested into why human stem cells or iPS cells that were originally made were not as flexible and very different from their mouse counterparts. And this has led us to a realization that pluripotent stem cells can exist into different grades. And there is a very high level of stemness, which we call it naive stem cells. I mean, like, it's really kind of completely erased. If you talk about it in humans, it corresponds to day 7 in development, versus the conventional ones that are more advanced correspond more to day 12 or 13 in development. So we showed, and it took us over years to really show and how to isolate these naive stem cells from humans. And these cells have different properties, different functionalities, including they can make the tissues that surround the embryo, which is like the placenta and the yolk sac. And they have more developmental potential than the conventional one. So that was an important discovery because it gives you the idea maybe you can make an embryo-like entity from stem cells, because an embryo, as you know, is composed of the embryo. It's called the embryo proper, like the embryo itself, and the extra-embryonic tissues. You need both compartments to really get normal development or model. So that was kind of an important thing for us to do. And then we really started thinking in general, you know, why in development do we have like naive stem cells that become primed stem cells and then they become an embryo? This is evolutionarily conserved. What's the benefit of that, which we don't have, actually? We don't know yet. But in order to study that, think about it, this is like a chemical reaction where naive cells become primed cells, become embryo. And I can grow naive or primed stem cells and convert them very easily in the dish. But I cannot see the readout of that interaction, which is having an embryo-like entity.
Yeah.
So to be able to do my research and go to the fundamentals of, I need A becomes B becomes C, all in front of my eyes in the dish. And this is basically what is the experiment that we're eventually doing is, you know, how do you take stem cells and make them become an embryo-like, which is what we call synthetic embryo or synthetic embryo models and these fractions. So that was the motivation. And also, that was the enablement part, which is being able to have these naive pluripotent cells. And then in parallel, you know, to do this, of course, in our research, I think everything always starts with the mouse. As we know a lot about mouse and mouse embryos and mouse stem cells, and typically everything was done first in the mouse, whether it was iPS cells or cloning or mitochondrial treatment and so forth. So really, we wanted to know whether can you do this in mouse really, or is this completely crazy, if you think about it, just like,
yeah.
So what in parallel we started thinking, okay, I want to make grow an embryo-like entity from stem cells in a dish, but I actually cannot do this even with a natural embryo. If I take a mouse natural embryo at later stages, I can't grow it. So obviously, you know, you need to know how to grow a natural embryo first, and then do this with synthetic embryo. So to summarize, basically, if our journey has been, I'll talk about it, is, you know, has been how to first grow natural mouse embryos for advanced stages outside the uterus, then make from stem cells synthetic mouse embryo models from mouse stem cells, and then move to humans, develop the human naive stem cells, which are essential.
Yeah.
And then from those, use all the knowledge from before and make human embryo models. So these kind of different lines of research, which were, some of them were planned, some of them were not planned, but kind of fit together to really, and as I said, this is the title of the last paper, has been really building in all of this knowledge from us, and I must mention also from other groups, to really, the last achievement was really to be able to show that really you can take stem cells and only stem cells without taking any embryo-derived material, and in the dish, make embryo models that have all compartments of the embryo, basically all the general compartments, whether it's the yolk sac or the embryo or the chorion. But why do we say they're models? Because they don't have everything that has the embryo. There are differences, there are limitations. So that's why it's very important for us, also in the mouse, we use the word synthetic embryo model or embryoid or that part. And that at the moment, and maybe never, I don't know yet, they may never be an exactly an authentic embryo.
Yeah.
We don't know that yet. And, I guess we'll touch on this more.
Yeah, no, that's an important, I think, call out. And I think we'll dig into it more of the details afterwards. Like, one question, you mentioned the iPSC cells and the work from Professor Yamanaka beforehand. Can we create, can we bring back iPSCs even further back in time to the naive state?
Yes, exactly. So this naive state is really can be, it's the way you grow the cells. So it doesn't matter if it's embryonic stem cells or iPS cells. It's about you put the cells into a certain state.
Okay.
So embryonic stem cells or iPS cells are the cell type.
Yeah.
And cell type can be in a different state. It can be in a naive or in a primed state.
Yeah, I think it's interesting because then that would mean that you could take virtually any type of cell, bring it back to this very naive state.
This is exactly what we do. And of course, this I want to say this line of research is also started because particularly with human iPS cells are much more variable. The lines, there's a huge variability, even if you make lines from a certain individual.
Yeah.
And as you can imagine, this is for biotech is also very annoying because if you want to make a universal differentiation protocol in every line that needs adaptation, that's really complicated. And we actually believe in something we also believe is because they are not in a naive condition. So in a way, naivete is about resetting and erasing all memory and restarting from scratch. So that's also one of the topics that we build on and understanding naivety. And we would like to use the embryo model, again, to answer how is what we call bias, you know, how do prime cells, can you bias a certain lineage or a certain one? So as I said, we're not only trying, so the embryo models will not only teach us about real embryos, hopefully, but they'll also teach us about how we can improve stem cell functions and how can we improve differentiation and so forth.
Understood. And did you foresee this sort of like the impact that it had and, you know, being recognized obviously in the scientific community, but also relayed by the media? Did you realize that this work would have such an impact or would be so communicated afterwards?
You know, like, I guess after when we saw the mouse, the excitement from the mouse work, I guess it became, you know, yes, that there was a buildup for it in a way. I would say, I think when we started working on the mouse, so I told you first we were just trying to grow mouse natural embryos in 21. And that was actually, you know, like many projects, that was kind of a side project. I actually never talked about it because it was very different from the usual stuff we did. Of course, I cared about it. But when it came out, you know, something like the New York Times kind of had a big push on it. And that's what many of my colleagues are like, oh, what, you know, why are you working on something so different? They didn't know that we were working on it. And I actually told them this is actually not very different because tell them what's next in line. And I think that's nice kind of to get the support and see the feedback that things fit together. And of course, you know, with us and work from also other groups. You know, there was starting really more and more buildup to realize that. And this is a very important type of research. There's a lot of potential, a lot of promise, a lot of ethical discussions. So it was all together, I think.
I see. So now if we want to go a bit deeper into the, you know, the experiment that you described and to understand a bit like what are the components and the conditions that need to be fulfilled if we want to obtain, you know, such an embryo model at day 14, I mean, without fertilization of an egg by a sperm and ultimately virtually like we're using cells that are, not coming from those type of cells.
We call it, no eggs, no sperm, no uterus.
Exactly. So what are the, if you had to explain it to, you know, someone who does not know so much about the field, how would you phrase it?
So I would phrase it that, so we have the ability to grow stem cells in a dish and as a, even, you know, we can make them from any adult cell and we can even bring them to this very early pristine state, which we call naive or virgin.
Yes.
And basically, what we uncover is that these cells have the ability themselves to self-organize into an embryo-like entity if we create the right environment for them. So in a way, I find that our discovery is just in finding that we can enable them to do what they're destined to do.
Yeah.
Creating that environment so that they can unleash their potential. I don't feel like that I actually endow them with that potential. It's a bit philosophical, right?
Yeah.
If you have a naive cell, that is the starting building block. And it's a reaction that nucleates and they start making the different cell types and different organizations. And basically that's what I would tell them, that we can grow stem cells and we can grow them that they are so have unlimited potential that they can express their what happens actually during normal development, because we all start from a zygote, which is a single cell.
Yeah.
And also there, you know, if you think, okay, you need the uterus, but in the end, the embryo is hardwired to do all these decisions and so forth. And basically, we can recapitulate a lot of that and capture that in a dish and let this reaction unfold. And we see embryo-like structures develop only from stem cells in the dish.
I see. And so how does it look like? Is it like an incubator where you can control the oxygen delivery, CO2, the pH, you have nutrients that play?
Yeah. Well, that's what I'm doing. It's different. And there's a lot of cooking.
Yeah.
depending also on the stage. So first, the first stage starts with like your typical lab, growing stem cells in a plastic dish in a 2D, and they have this liquid on top of that, which is the food.
Yeah,
we change the food every day, and within the cells we expand them. We call it splitting. We split them after 5 days to expand them more. So then you have these stem cells that are naive stem cells, and then we make them do 3 or 4 fractions. If mouse is 3 and humans is 4, and we start changing the media to give nudge. Some of them to become placenta and then some of them to become a yolk sac. Some they will stay as towards the embryo proper. And then we start mixing cells at certain ratios. And we use special wells that kind of like, it's like a small well, or a micro wells, what it's called, really that they aggregate. We put about mouse 25 cells or 100 cells. And they grow for the first 4 days. And then after that, we move into, they would like to be in other plates that are very non-adherent, and we put them on shakers. They're just like shaking. And then, particularly for later stages in the mouse, we used a special incubator that we I told you we had developed how to grow natural embryos at that stage,
yeah,
which looks then like an incubator that has kind of a wheel. It has like glass bottles in which we put the embryos or embryo models in, and you have the liquid, which again, is a specific special liquid. And then you have a gas mixer that controls a lot of the parameters, whether the airflow, the concentration of oxygen, the pressure, the light. We shouldn't expose them to too much light. So that is kind of the things that we developed over the time. And that's actually the so overall, it's all tissue culture. But yes, some of them becomes more kind of 3D, perfusion based on and so forth. And I should say, I think I always said that our research, this is a way to do it. And I don't think this is the best way or something. I mean, there's a lot more development on that aspect. But at least, we did a lot of optimization. And, it's a very good proof of principle. But that is by no means says that this is the only way or the best way. That is, in fact, I'm quite sure it's not. And but in this type of research, as you can imagine, it's very hard. I mean, some of the projects we work on 6 or 7 years, but it's very encouraging to get that initial success. Also, now scientists are human beings, particularly my students. I need to motivate them to keep pushing. And it's nice to once you have, okay, it's possible. Let's try harder. Let's make it more efficient. Let's go to rabbits, non-human primates like chimps and humans so far. That's typically and some. As part of the team works in these incubators, some others work about, so what do you mean when you say you nudge the cells to become placenta? What is exactly these cells are? And these things are very key to improve the efficiency and the quality, I think, of the embryo models.
And so for now, in terms of the process, is this something that we master, as you say, to perfection, or is the failure rate still fairly high?
The efficiency is low. It's about 1%.
1%. Okay.
Again, I should say our standards are very, very high when we score something as positive.
Yeah.
And we go to also very late stage because at earlier, the later the stage, at least
the more difficult. Yeah.
But I want to modestly make the comparison. So, when Yamanaka described iPS cells, they were 0.008% efficient.
Yeah, that's much less.
By 10 years of mechanistic research, really, and now it becomes efficiency or somewhere even like up to 100%, candy, or 10% to 100%.
Yeah.
So I'm quite sure the efficiency will go higher. We already actually have the result that we can bring it higher. And thus, again, like many times in science, I think basic research understanding, so what do you mean with self-organization and engineering and these wells and the shape, and should we direct the shape a little bit and so forth, brings up efficiencies and will allow us to answer more questions. So a little bit of this tech development promotes biology, and biology, molecular biology promotes tech development. It's always both ways.
So most likely in the future, we'll get to a success rate that increases. I don't know if it's by the same factor as what we see with the iPSC cells, but there's hope.
Yeah, I'm very hopeful that we, I think for sure, we've seen significant improvement. Let's put it this way.
Super. Putting the ethical aspects on the side and considering purely the biology at play, and you made an important call out in the beginning regarding the fact that these are synthetic models. They are not the 100% replicates of human embryos. How far could we go in terms of the development of those synthetic embryos outside the womb? Is there, we reached day 14. Do you think if we would have let them further develop, they would have further developed? What's your take on this?
Yeah, that's, I think, the core of the question. So I often, remind myself and remind my colleagues or in discussions like here, and the field, in a way that this topic is not new in the sense, we've been a lot of discussions about using real embryos, which is usually excess embryos from IVF treatments, usually people who underwent treatment. There are frozen embryos that they either get discarded or can be donated to science. And scientists have been learning by trying to grow them further, maybe, as you mentioned, day 14 or more than 14 days, and try to learn from them. And already,
yeah,
there's a lot of discussions, how long should we grow them? Some countries limit this to 14 days. Now, the International Society of Stem Cell Research has recommended that they no longer limit
to 14 days.
They recommend actually to go later, if you have justification, try to use, you know, minimal numbers of embryo and so forth. Some countries do not have this limitation, like Israel doesn't have a 14-day rule limit on natural embryos.
Yeah.
Now the UK is trying to change that. The US is always, it's a funny situation. The NIH doesn't fund it, but it's not restricted, so scientists can do it there in most of the states. So therefore, you know, a lot of these discussions have been on, you know, because it's like, what is life? What's a human being? Or what is a person? And these sessions. So when you talk about embryo models, I think it narrows down to a simple question. When does an embryo model become
an actual embryo?
Because then you treat it as an embryo, and you treat it as an embryo as, you know, your society, your legislation, you know, your existence. It's not the way that the question is very much overlap. But perhaps it might, you know, kind of, you know, even put more spotlight to really like what is a human embryo and how similar should it be, and based on ability. And there's a lot of discussions. And I want to say it's a good thing that, you know, one of the things we, you know, I'd like to participate in this podcast and these things, because I think it's our duty as scientists, and actually also the International Society of Stem Cell Research, ICC, actually really, as part of the guidelines, also asked scientists to engage the public in their research.
Yeah.
Nobody feels that we're doing things in the shadow, to get feedback from the public and really explain why we're doing this. And again, I think, you know, because often when you hear the word embryo and synthetic embryo in a dish, we all think of The Matrix, which is a great movie. I love that. But, you know, we're not, we shouldn't let a movie limit the benefit.
Yeah.
So first thing, you know, I tell people that, you know, we are not, this is not a method that treats, can replace pregnancy. You cannot, I think, replace human pregnancy. And cannot, you know, grow embryo for that long and so forth, even if it's exactly like the embryo, and it's not. But is what I told you before, is think about it. There's so much we don't know about early human embryo. And these first 6 weeks are when most pregnancy failures happen, when most developmental defects happen. They're discovered later, but they actually occur during these periods.
Yeah.
Drug toxicity is very, you know, our viruses tend, you know, embryos are very sensitive during this period. So it's really, I think about it, it's a drama. I mean, it's a ball of cells turning into, in within 4 weeks, into something that anybody on the street will tell you, yes, this looks like an embryo. It's an organ embryo. So this, we, and there is no other way to study this in humans. And you know, mice are great, but they're not human. And perhaps now with stem cells, and even the efficiency is low, and even we may never be exactly like an embryo. See, that's why it's a model. We can look at these processes and ask some of the questions. So it's never an all or nothing phenomenon. We're trying our best to do that. And then when you talk about, I think when you come back, having mentioned all of this, and I think when you talk about the, you know, the ethics, and so first of all, as I mentioned, you know, a lot of discussions are, let's assume it is exactly like the embryo, and then there's the question, at which day should we draw the line, which is very similar for between them. But I also think that this, I personally, when I think of something, it's, again, the question of saying something ethical and unethical is a very reductionist in its nature, is problematic. I do think a lot of things we do, because even using, you know, excess IVF embryos, there are ethical issues with it. I think it's a pros and cons. And is there a benefit that overweighs the harm?
Yeah.
And I think, you know, let's think of let's think of things in a context. Okay, if you have someone who's about to die because he cannot find a suitable bone marrow donor.
Yeah.
Or you have a woman who, for natural reason, or just because he actually got chemotherapy and she overcame cancer, but her ovarian reserves are so low that she doesn't have eggs. So, do these individuals have the right to give, you know, with the knowledge and full consent as adults, stem cells, and make embryo models from their cells to day 40 or day 70, depending on the organ that is needed, and take cells and save his life, or being able to make her own eggs so that she can go to a regular fertility clinic and, you know, with her husband to experiment. So that is, I think, the scenario. As scientists, I think what is really important, at least for me, is really make sure that the public, its decision is based on fact.
Yeah.
They can maybe decide, no, we don't want this, but it to be decided on fast. If they want to rule this out because they think this is somebody is going to steal a cell from me and put it inside the uterus and clone me, that shouldn't be the case because that's actually not possible, okay? And this is actually one of the, it's a very justified concern. I mean, the public is not scientists, and it's our duty to explain why this is not possible.
Yeah.
As I told you, even for natural embryos, after the 64-cell stage, even for natural embryos from any mammalian species, if you put it inside the uterus, even if you wanted to break the law,
it would not work.
It would never work because they cannot implant. And the final comment on that, we should also, you know, be imaginative, and we're subject or experimentalists, is that, you know, so now we're trying to make embryo model as much as possible similar to the real embryo. But then we can also make embryo models that are developmentally restricted, meaning they have no heart tissue and no brain tissue.
Yeah.
And for many bioethicists or religious people, you will say, well, there's no cognition, there's no sense of pain. Even at later stages, this cannot be a viable human being / person. Therefore, what I would say is like, it's very early, we're not there yet, but it's good that we're starting these discussions there so that if this becomes relevant, we are ready, we're discussing this, we know what the society wants to be there. And so I don't think there's like kind of a red flag, red alarm to kind of sound a siren at the moment, and not even in the close future. But we should be having those discussions just also to alleviate any concern of the public and also get feedback from the public.
Yeah.
But then as this goes.
And would also be like a therapeutic avenue to actually, you touched on some of the, sometimes the diseases that embryos have. Could this be also like a way to address those?
Yes, definitely. So it's not there. I think the applications are different. Some of them I don't think we can even predict now.
Yeah.
For example, I'll give you one example. Today, you cannot, if you have an excellent new drug, you cannot give it to pregnant women because you're not allowed, you don't know if the effect is going to harm the embryo, and just the FDA doesn't approve and they don't want to take that risk. We've actually shown in mice that when we grow in this kind of artificial uterus, you want to call it, and we took drugs that are known to cause certain defects,
yeah,
and we add them, we immediately saw the same defects that are known to happen. So if you can imagine, this may be a platform in the future to test drugs. Perhaps, you know, maybe one day the FDA will say, well, if it looks safe in embryo models, we're going to allow a small initial screening. So let's just give you one application. If you think about viruses, you know, Zika virus, CMV virus, alcohol toxicity, these things can be really studied at these stages.
Mm-hmm.
Genetic defects, you know, trisomies, monosomies, malformations, we even don't know. Even, you know, like, I think if we go on like on YouTube, I think we've all probably maybe seen a movie for frog embryo or a zebrafish embryo, how it grew this beautiful. We actually don't have that from anything
humans,
human or non-human primates. We only have it from mice. And by the way, the shape of the mouse embryo is actually very different from other mammalians. The mouse is actually an outlier. So even that kind of basic knowledge of seeing, you know, tissues folding or how do certain kind of lumens happen and when, just visualizing is already going to be telling a lot. So we really, really don't know at these stages in a dynamic way. And I think that knowledge is not only for curiosity. I think it is critical because this is when embryo makes its organs and this is when the things go wrong. We need to be able to really, as much as possible, to learn about it.
Yeah, no, that's fascinating. You mentioned, I think, in the intro that you created Renewal Bio in 2022. The mission of that company is to renew humanity, making all of us young and healthy.
Yeah,
I think that's what it means.
Renewing human health, well, like not renewing us in the sense of like...
It's not like what Brian Johnson is doing.
Even if we want it, I would say.
Okay.
But, yeah, well, but we don't want, I guess.
Is this the like, is this, can you explain us why you created the company? Is this like a commercial vehicle to bring those medical applications, you know, to the masses?
Yeah, definitely. I think, you know, obviously this is a a type of massive research efforts is going to be needed. It's, you know, tens of labs and companies are going to, I think, are needed to really progress the field. This is way bigger than a single or a few labs doing that. And sometimes, you know, having, you know, a company try to focus on certain aspects is a good way to develop technologies. And, you know, in terms of recruiting funding, many times there are things that are very technical, perhaps, you know, a PhD student doesn't like to do. They're not like cerebral enough for for even for that aspect. And the third is, to be honest, you know, I'm an advisor to that company, so I'm not actually the scientific sort of the company, meaning I can advise, but they many times do not accept what I do and do things differently, which I really like, because I would like to see what others do with things we started and and really. So this exchange also is very very happening. Pharma is also it's the, you know, great brother to academia to push science and knowledge. And yes, they're more focused on eventually the goals and targets that I mentioned, but obviously development and research has to be has to come first. Yes, they're more, you know, they're less interested into mouse or rabbit, perhaps, while they're very more focused on human stuff, but other than that, I think overall there is, like, you can think of it as like a different lab working on this and bring things there.
Oh, I understand. Looking at the time, I mean, we're already like in the conversation since 40 minutes, and it's been really fascinating. And I'm very grateful that you joined us. So we're, you know, slightly getting towards the end, and there's always, you know, a few questions that I ask the guests at every episode. And I think the first one is, what resources would you recommend us to check out, you know, to know more about the field in which you evolve? So I think we'll put the link to the paper we discussed in the show notes, but are there, you know, other books or publications or websites that you would encourage the audience to look into?
Yes, definitely. I think, first of all, I think the website of this ICCR, the International Society of Stem Cell Research, it also has kind of it's a good resource for the general public to explain about types of research. There is also a book by Alfonso Martinez Arias recently came out called The Master Builder, which talks about the power of cells and the history a lot about studying how embryos form from, you know, really early days. This is, you know, for more kind of intellectual in general, not only, you know, because we build, you know, we really stand on the shoulders of giants of a lot of embryology work in frogs and so forth on these aspects. I think a lot of, you know, the scientific website news have been, you know, whether it's Nature News, Science News, and podcasts like yours and others, I think have done overall quite a good job for explaining this. Many scientists that have also are good to explain it. And I would also encourage you also to look at papers, you know, even
for sure.
Don't get intimidated by the jargon. You know, if you understand 5 to 10%, you can get the idea of what's going on. It's less about the details of it. So all our papers are what's called open access. So you don't need subscription to a journal to see them because we pay extra money. Actually, it's very expensive. But because of that, we also think that we want the public to
know,
open and look things. And there are videos, and even the experiments themselves are videotaped in our papers.
Could not be more transparent. The second question, and there maybe it's a bit early to tell because we discussed like potential medical applications, but we're not there yet. But can you share with us an anecdote from your work you know, that made you realize the impact that you were having or that you could have on people's lives down the line?
I think experiments were when we added, you know, drugs that, like, you know, thalidomide or other drugs that, you know, they're infamous because they were given to people 70 and 80 years ago and caused defects, and they're really now defects, very tragic. Therefore, we know when we just added them and immediately saw the
thing
develop outside, you just said, you know, really, at least, you know, this, I think this is really achievable. Mm-hmm. Even if we want to say, even, you know, it's good to have dreams and ambitions, and even if only 20% work, that is also fine. And there's one way to find out, which is to do research and more research about it.
In every episode, you know, I get a lot of inspiration from the guests I have the chance to have on the show. And, you know, for you, without a doubt, it's no exception. There are certainly other people and pioneers in the field that you admire, can be also in the same research field, but others, like Leo, for example. If there would be one or a few that you would recommend as potential guests for the podcast, who would they be and why would you recommend them?
There's definitely a number of them. It's not easy to choose, but I think Professor Alfonso Martinez Arias, who's now in Barcelona, I think is a very inspiration, because he is, not only has made a seminal contribution to make what's called gastroloids, or sort of like more simplified embryo models without other tissues around them.
Yeah.
But it's just also his knowledge in developmental biology and of the history of science is unparalleled. And he's a real scholar. At the personal level, actually, he has been, I want to say, almost the mentor I never had yet, it by accident. But better late than never. he's always share our data with him and to think about it, because again, with the human development is really uncharted territory. It's not that there's a lot we don't know. From there, I just realized how smart and how much experience and knowledge he has, which is always, as I mentioned, is expressed in his book. But I think definitely he stands out as such a person.
How can we get in touch with you? Can we write you on LinkedIn if people want to reach out to you?
I want to say actually sometimes on social media or LinkedIn, I may not read messages, like I don't follow closely. So I want to say if you Google, you can easily find my email, and I read all my emails and I try to answer everything. And that's like the
good old way.
Yeah.
Is there anything else you would like to share with us?
I think, you know, again, thanks for having me. And you know, it went so by, so fast, and I enjoyed really the discussions. And I want to thank the listeners. And really want to say again that it's very important in science to, in different fields, even when there are concerns, not to shy away from certain fields of science. I often say, you know, just because someone can make a nuclear bomb, you don't ban nuclear physics, which obviously has a lot of advantages. And, you know, somebody can make a very dangerous, nasty virus, you don't ban virus research. Look how COVID saved lives. And this is no different. I think any fields of research, and even now with AI, there are ethical concerns and questions. It's natural. We should just tackle them and be patient and trust in the end and regulation. I do believe in the end works.
Thanks a lot. So, I mean, for those that are still with us, thank you for listening. If you found the conversation interesting, as I did very much, share the episode with another person that would be, you know, interested in the topic. I keep getting a lot of feedback for the podcast, so please keep sharing it. It's always very helpful and helps me, you know, carrying it forward. If you haven't done it also yet, please subscribe and leave a 5-star review on the streaming platform you use. And don't forget to follow our activities on LinkedIn, on the website, and the podcast newsletter. Thanks so much again, Jacob, for your time.
Thank you, Ratfield. Great fun. Thanks, everyone.
Thank you for listening and making it all the way to the end of this episode. I hope you enjoyed it. All the notes are available in the episode description. If you liked it, don't hesitate to share it with your relatives, friends, or colleagues, and subscribe to the podcast. I would be extremely grateful if you could leave a 5-star review on Spotify and Apple Podcasts. It really helps Impulse move up in the rankings. Feel free to reach out to me by email or through LinkedIn if you want to share your feedback, questions, or suggest potential guests. Thanks a lot, and see you in the next one.